Campus FM presents an international seminar organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies entitled Captivating the Real in Narrative Research.
Okay, it is with great pleasure that I welcome you to the seminar Captivating the Real in Narrative Research organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies. The highlight of the seminar is having Professor Danny Goodley contributing together with Dr. Marilyn Clark from the Department of Youth and Community Studies, Dr. Simon Galia from the Department of Education Studies, our second cohort reading the MA Youth and Community Studies, and myself. The need to focus some extra energy in the area of narrative research has been called for over these last years, even as we accompanied our students in their studies. So basically, that's why we're here, because of students. Unfortunately, this hall only has a capacity of about 170 places. We are using the only now because we were quite concerned whether we would hit the 40 mark, but in reality, we had to practically ask about 40 or 50 people who showed an interest in attending the seminar not to come. So this is evidence of the fascination and profound curiosity that there is in this method, come methodology, we will be engaging with today. But thank God for technology. So Campus FM have agreed to transmit the seminar in their open seminar series, and therefore this national radio will have the responsibility of spreading the good news. So basically you could have saved on your fiver and just set it out in the comfort and warmth of your homes and fireplaces with a glass of cognac or a nice chilly cold beer. So allow me to just to mention a couple of people. I would like to thank my colleagues at the Department of Youth and Community Studies who have been massively supportive, most especially Dr. Marilyn Clark, who kept reminding me that this seminar needs to cost less than all the budget dedicated to the department for this year, and Ms. Lillian Spiteri, our clerk, has been so great in helping us bring it all together and having to put up with the ongoing and endless new demands to take care of. A word of appreciation also goes to the Department of Psychology, namely the Program of Inclusive Education, and its director and head of the Psychology Department, Dr. Elena Tante-Bourlo, who created space in Professor Goodley's tight schedule to make it to the seminar. So enough of my blather, some logistics. The seminar will be split up in two parts, as you can see in your program. The first part will have Dr. Marilyn Clark, Dr. Simon Galia, and myself in the sequence, sharing their presentation. Then it will be a coffee break, which will be held downstairs, following which our MA cohort will contribute their bit, before having Professor Dan Goodley and some time for the floor. I would like to remind you that the CD of Professor Goodley's contribution and the PPTs of all other contributors, together with the certificate of participation, will be made available in the near future and will communicate that accordingly. So we encourage you to make sure that you sign in your names and details, especially your addresses, in the form that is being circulated. I would like to invite Dr. Valerie Sollers, our dean, who has always been extremely supportive to all our departmental initiatives, to set the ball rolling and officially open the seminar.
Very many thanks to all of you for supporting the initiatives which the faculty takes from time to time. Again, on your behalf, I would like to thank Andrew for taking this opportunity to bring you all together. It will be very, I'm sure you're in for a very interesting afternoon. Unfortunately, you'll soon see me dashing, because the faculty is a vibrant faculty, and this afternoon we have no less than 3 or 4 activities going on simultaneously by different colleagues. So I hope that you will enjoy your session and you will find all that the well-known speakers have to say about narrative inquiry useful in your work as well as in your studies for those of you who are pursuing this area of research. So enjoy your evening.
I would like to introduce Dr. Marilyn Clark. Dr. Clark is my head of department, so I'm duty-bound to say something nice about her. Dr. Marilyn Clark is a social scientist. She is a qualitative researcher favoring the biographical narrative approach and grounded theory. Her main research interests are addiction, criminality, stigma, adolescent behavior, and resiliency. She's currently the head of department of the said department, Department of Youth and Community Studies. She has to put up with me, so that's no easy task to do, Dr. Mellon-Clark.
So I've been asked to talk about locating narrative research within the Youth and Community Studies research agenda. And I thought it would also be a good idea, because narrative research is something relatively new, to also give a little bit of an introduction to the approach. So basically that's what I'll be doing. I'll be trying to sort of highlight what are the main points in narrative inquiry, as well as locating this within our research agenda at the department. Okay. I often like to start by trying to see where is a word coming from. So in fact, in Latin, the noun narrario means a story, and the verb narrare, to tell or narrate. A narrative is thus a story that tells a sequence of events that is significant for the narrator and or his or her audience. Telling our lives as they happen to us is a pervasive activity in the social world, perhaps the oldest form of cultural learning. Narratives are integral to human culture. As we see here, the Stone Age people, this is how they communicated and how they passed on their culture from one generation to the other. True stories, we value personal history and make sense of our lives. In fact, according to Roland Barthes, the French literary critic and social theorist, narrative is present in every age, in every place, in every society. Nowhere is nor has been a people without narrative. All classes, all human groups have their narratives. Narrative is international, trans-historical, trans-cultural. It is simply there, like life itself. One way of structuring complex human experiences is to organize them into meaningful units or stories. Storytelling is a natural way of recounting experience, a practical solution to a fundamental problem in life, creating reasonable order out of experience. According to Connolly and Clandenin, two authors who have written extensively on the subject, all human beings are storytellers who individually and socially lead storied lives. Personal storytelling is now seen as a valid means of knowledge production, and the interdisciplinary potential of narrative is highlighted. Plummer writes how stories have recently moved center stage in social thought. In anthropology, they are seen as the pathways to understanding culture. In psychology, they are the basis of identity. In history, they provide the tropes for making sense of the past. In psychoanalysis, they provide narrative truths for analysis. What will this paper tackle? So this paper will highlight how the narrative approach has much to offer youth and community studies. Clearly, this is our main interest. There are lots of youth and community studies students here today. Apart from encouraging a plurality of truths to become known, they also provide ways to understand the interactions that occur among individuals, groups, and societies. The level of analysis, therefore, does not remain on the individual. Thus, narrative has the capacity to attend to context as well as idiosyncrasy. This paper will argue that narrative primarily has empowerment potential. At Youth and Community Studies, the word empowerment is something we use all the time, and this is something that this paper will stress. Okay. We need to explore. What do narrative researchers actually do? Okay. So if as Barthes claims in the quote at the start of this paper, narrative is everywhere and everything is narrative, and if at the same time we think it is worth studying, what is so distinctive about it? Okay. Brunner distinguishes between narrative and paradigmatic knowledge. Paradigmatic knowledge is that kind of knowledge that we study in terms of main theoretical conceptual frameworks. In contrast to paradigms in the social sciences, narrative is temporal and processual, situated or particular. The ultimate aim of narrative is the investigation of human life and the interpretation of experience. Researchers in a variety of disciplines have come to recognize narrative as the most likely medium to capture the contingencies of human experiences as lived in context and over time. Post-structuralists emphasize the futility of attempting to describe a universalized, orderly social world. Instead, today, we seek out local knowledges. While paradigms are schematic, abstract, and general, narratives are sequential, up close and personal. Particularly, narratives are able to relate human experience as it unfolds over time. A lived present with an experiential past anticipating a future. This perspective helps us distinguish narrative interests from others and to distinguish mere utterances from utterances with a narrative character. Even if narrative inquiry is a relatively new branch within the qualitative or interpretive research tradition, much has already been written about this theme. When reading about narratives and narrative research, one is left with the impression that the focus of attention spreads in many directions. There is, in fact, a lack of consensus about what it represents, what it is. A consensus does not exist as to what constitutes narrative research. Those seeking a basic understanding of narratology must forge their own construction of the inquiry process. Three main interpretations prevail. Okay, I'll take you through these three main interpretations. Primarily, and very often, the concept of narrative is used in connection with how to represent a qualitative research study. For example, Cresswell, an important researcher from the qualitative tradition, writes how a case study, a biographical study, a phenomenological study, or an ethnographic study may all have a narrative form of representation. The narrative representation particularly appears to be connected to biographies and autobiographies. Within this tradition, it seems as if the term biography and narrative are used synonymously. Secondly, some researchers have focused on the narrative approach as a method of inquiry as opposed to a mode of representation. And a research genre situated within the qualitative or interpretative research family and including techniques for analysis. Thirdly, the narrative approach is viewed not as a method, but rather as a frame of reference in a research process. A conceptual framework wherein narrators are seen as producers and transmitters of reality. These interpretations are in fact not mutually exclusive. In line with Connolly and Clandenin, the narrative approach may be viewed both as the phenomenon, what we are studying, and the method, the way we study it. So, what narrative researchers do is brought more clearly to light when one considers the several common characteristics that fit many narrative studies. A common theme in narrative work is that it emphasizes the importance of learning from participants in a context. Therefore, the power balance between the researcher and the person who is being researched, or the group being researched, is changed. The emphasis is that they are the experts and we learn from them. In most narrative studies, the stories or the field texts typically provide the raw data for analysis. The third point is that all narrative studies include restoring. In the restoring phase and the telling of the themes, the narrative researcher includes rich detail about the context of the experiences. This is perhaps how it differs from grounded theory or from other forms of qualitative research. The narrative is restored based on narrative elements, such as the problem, the characters, the setting, actions, and resolution. Restoring is the process of analyzing for key elements in the story, example, time, place, plot, and scene, and then rewriting the story to place it within a time sequence. Often, these stories have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Cortazzi suggests that it is the emphasis on sequence that, in fact, sets narrative apart from other genres of qualitative research. A fourth point is that the qualitative data analysis may be both descriptive and thematic. In addition, the researcher often writes into the reconstituted story a chronology of events, describing the individual's past, present, and future experiences, lodged within a specific setting or context. Finally, the participant, and I feel that this is the most important aspect of narrative research, the participant is involved at each stage of the research process, from formulating the research agenda, to the creation of the field texts, to the final written, restoried rendition of the individual's experiences. This involves negotiating relationships between the researcher and the researched in order to lessen the potential gap between the narrative told and the narrative which is in fact reported. To come to youth and community studies, what is our research agenda? When youth and community researchers use the narrative method, they are brought more closely into the investigative process. Thus, we come into contact with participants as young people engaged in the process of interpreting themselves. We work then with what is said and with the context that it is said in. What research participants say, this is very important, has significance for them beyond the interview. It is part of their ongoing self-story and represents a manifestation of their psychosocial world. It is this psychosocial reality that we are interested in. When narratives are looked on within the framework of socio-cultural theory, we are reminded of the interlinking between the individual and her or his context. As individuals are telling their stories, they are not isolated and independent of their context. On the contrary, it is important to remember that the individual in question is irreducibly connected to his or her social, cultural, and institutional setting. Narratives, therefore, capture both the individual and the context, the young person and the community. In our department, novice and aspiring researchers, primarily our students and ourselves as well, are encouraged to develop interpersonal, context-based relationships with participants in their research. In the youth and community context, narrative is seen as a way of combating hegemonic tendencies. The Department of Youth and Community Studies staff and students are determined to engage in research that promotes the self-reliance and creativity of young people and that facilitates identity renegotiation and maintenance, and active participation of young people in society and institutions. It seeks to understand cultural diversity, combat racism and xenophobia, and promote the participation of disadvantaged young people. Narrative research gives young people a voice. Clandenin and Connolly suggest that the reconstructed stories of people's lives are a fundamental educational tool. Narratives draw our attention to how people create and renew themselves. According to these authors, people live stories, and in the telling of them, reaffirm them, modify them, and create new ones. Stories educate the self and others, including the young and those such as researchers who are new to their communities. In youth studies, we are concerned with representing informant stories in a respectful manner, and with including them in the process of interpretation and analysis. According to Goodley, I have to make reference to him since now I'm the main speaker, the role of the author's voice is then to describe authentic experiences and provide explanations of the interaction between the individual and the social world. An empowering research process. Narrative research has the potential to challenge taken-for-granted beliefs. It is in this way that it combats hegemony, in fact. Taken-for-granted beliefs, assertions, and assumptions, including those made by revered social theorists. For as Drury and Winslade contend, narrative researchers are not tempted to sanitize research by appealing to scientific facts and linear trajectories. This means that we do not use the language of certainty, but instead present ideas in ways that are more tentative, circular, and multiple. Most importantly, narratives are able to authorize the stories that ordinary people tell. With the capacity to recognize people's strengths and engage people in active, meaning-making dialogues, narrative approaches, notably those informed by critical ideas, may help youth researchers move beyond a strict problem and risk focus that has traditionally been the approach since the famous Stanley Hall. Carefully used, they may be effective methods in cross-cultural work and community work. Emphasizing curiosity and reflexivity, narrative methods may aid those who seek to democratize professional relationships. By more obviously opening up points of contest and difference, they are therefore potentially compatible with emancipatory values, especially those pertaining to social justice and self-determination. Most importantly, this paper argues for conducting narrative research with the explicit intent of transforming participants' lives by opening up new subjective possibilities. Emphasizing subjective agency, emancipatory stands for the political aim of research to dismantle the prisons of received identities and discourses of exclusion, and to encourage the proliferation of differences of all kinds. By way of conclusion, in youth studies, it is important to highlight the collaborative, dialogic nature of the relationship between the researcher and the research participant. What seems to be important here, when discussing this issue, is the necessity of time and space to develop a caring situation in which both the researcher and the participants feel comfortable. This is best served by a period of befriending. A non-judgmental attitude and a sense of equality between the participants and the researcher is particularly important in narrative inquiry. The ideal is that the narrator and the researcher reach a joint intersubjective understanding of the narratives that occur during the research process. However, a dilemma can occur, and often does, if the researcher and the research subjects interpret specific events in different ways, or if the research subjects question the interpretation of the researcher. Collaboration should therefore be extended to data analysis and not simply data collection. Closely connected to this dilemma is the question of whether informants always have a better appreciation of their actions than the outside observer. Must the accounts of those individuals whose customs or actions are being explained always be accepted as the correct account of the phenomenon in question? The researcher can never be sure that interviewees are not distorting the truth, telling outright lies, or exaggerating a point. According to Sartre, all tales are inherently untrue. It is informants' interpretations of their situation that is deemed important, not what actually happened, but how they perceive things to have happened. According to Phillips, it is difficult to tell if a particular story is a reflection of the facts in the case or whether it has been shaped by the storyteller. In my opinion, the dilemma outlined here could and should be resolved by including both the researchers and the research subjects' points of view in the research report. Perhaps in this way, the multi-voicedness of the narrative would appear more. Okay. By way of conclusion, a final note. Creating a narrative implies a process whereby an accurate story that occurs in collaboration between the researcher and the research subject becomes fixed in a written text. People then use it to make assumptions, to study about it, etc. This has very important ethical implications and requires an appreciation of the politics involved with making knowledge. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Clark. We'll be having time for discussion at a later stage. So if people would like to jot notes so that we make sure that we get all the input and then we have time for discussion from the floor. I would like to introduce Dr. Simone Gallian. Dr. Simone Gallian, Senior Lecturer of Philosophy of Education in the Faculty of Education. She has published papers in local and international journals that reflect her interdisciplinary research interests, including philosophy of education, educational theory, and feminism, with particular focus on narrative research and genealogical modes of inquiry. She is a friend, a colleague, a close collaborator, and needs help with the PowerPoint at this point. Yeah?
I shall be taking another aspect of narrative inquiry, one that is mostly related to something that follows what Marin has talked about, that is, what happens when people listen to and hear the narrative, the stories, okay? I shall immediately start off with narrating a story from Lou Drovnik's book, In Search of Carmen Caruana, and I would like you to listen to the story. the vast distance that would separate them was incomprehensible, and she was terrified that she would never be able to make her way back to her beloved home, to sit in her mother's kitchen, to see her mother's face, and hear her mother's voice. But the separation from her mother faded into insignificance when 3 weeks into the journey, she faced a mother's worst nightmare, a nightmare etched so deeply in the recesses of her mind that even the passing of many years did not manage to blur it. It was the memory of her little boy that as he had been before, she walked up the gangway to the ship that was to take him to the father who had never seen him. His chubby legs waving in the air as she changed him, his smile when he entered the room, the tight curls that she twirled around her fingers when he sat in the comfort of her warm lap. How hard it was to eradicate the picture of the way he was 3 weeks into the journey. His eyes blue, his face paper white, his limbs lying limp by his side, and she sitting huddled on the narrow bunk with him in her arms, and her girls staring at them, not knowing what to do and how to amuse themselves. Her nightmare was edged with other memories too of that time when in her desolation she looked around her to find someone who would help her. She remembered the Godzitin who went to her with a packet of sandwiches and a bottle of lemonade. When he heard that she hadn't been able to leave the cabin and her sick boy behind. She remembered the women chanting that they didn't want men down there when he went to help her, and to her sorrow, she hadn't even known his name, so she could thank him. She knew the names of the saints she had invoked in her endless vigil while the ship forged ahead towards the promised land. The vows she had made, which she knew she would never be able to fulfill because her prayers were not to be answered. Yet one of her prayers was, if he is to die, let it be on land, she had demanded in her grief. She didn't want that so that his father would see him. No, that she could bear. The other thing, she feared most, that haunted her waking and her sleeping, the words she had heard the women whisper among themselves, thinking she couldn't hear them. Iwad bohil bahar, she heard them say. They'll throw him in the sea. She would go after him, of that she was certain, and she saw clearly what she would do if that happened. She would climb over the railing and she would jump straight after him, shoes, clothes, and all. But she had been spared that because her little boy had lasted until they arrived in Melbourne. So this is a story of a migrant who hoped to make a new life in another country. The articulation and presentation of such narratives could mark a point of departure for migrants, as Merlin has well explained. For researchers and academics, they could and should mark deeper ones that make them reflect on the themes that emerge from the stories conceived as data to identify and understand the movements of migrating identities. This story, however, marked a somewhat particular point of departure for me as a woman who is concerned with feminist philosophies and narrative research. These stories have instigated me to rethink the familiar methodological principles of narrative inquiry that I have taken for granted, particularly the idea that narratives are simple and effective means of conscientizing the Maltese of migrants' experiences by representing the meanings of life stories that migrants themselves have created. I think you've already noticed that these stories were actually told by Maltese migrants. These are the narratives of their journeys to Australia that took place some 50 to 60 years ago. The story that I have read is written by Lou Drovnik and told by Maltese migrants and told by Maltese migrants. Lou is a Maltese-Australian woman migrant who has emigrated with her sister to Australia in the 1960s. Through her feminist political commitment, she has documented the hard journeys of change and adaptation of these migrants, reinventing them, fictionalizing them. And this is the cover of her latest book. I have juxtaposed Lou's stories of Maltese migrants with the pictures of local migrants that arrive here in our country to explore the use of Maltese migrant stories to reflect on the relation between their experiences and the relating aspects of narrating an experience. This is another of her book, another book of hers, okay? This idea came up during a talk that Lou Drovnik herself has made some months ago at this university, where this story was narrated. One response from the floor pondered on the possible uses of migrant stories in making the Maltese people aware of the experience and needs of migrants as they arrive in Malta. Here I shall take up this idea and reflect on the various methodological implications of such a use. Throughout the last few months, there have been several attempts at using the stories of migrants from Africa to conscientize people of the terrible journeys of suffering that they endure and the inhumane conditions, physical and emotional, that make their first years of migration truly memorable. Stories appear in local magazines and newspapers regularly. I have used these stories myself for pedagogical purposes in lectures that discuss the issues of difference. Drawing on my theoretical baggage of narrative methodologies, I could easily make good arguments for the political functions of narrative. I have found the work of feminist philosopher Iris Marion Young particularly useful here. Iris Marion Young argues for the use of narrative as a simple and accessible means through which people who suffer injustices make their voices heard and experiences known. Narratives provide the public space for an articulation and representation of an injustice, an opportunity for making it known to others, and for naming it, the creation of a word, a language, about something that the public has not yet realized that it is a problem. Iris Marion Young also argues for the rhetorical aspects of narrative that focus on an enhanced understanding of different values that people might hold and why they have come to hold them. Yet, in spite of this political awareness of the difference narratives and narrative research can make in conscientizing people of the different, I am increasingly becoming aware and concerned with the indifference to these narratives. Despite the few students that are touched by the experiences of the migrant girl who is struggling to be accepted in schools, there are a larger number that do not see how they, as teachers, could possibly find, or should I dare say, waste their time on the ignorant and the hopeless. Despite the stories that are told publicly in magazines and in newspapers, in seminars, as well as occasionally as part of the sermon during a Sunday Mass, disrespectful comments and racist attitudes towards migrants persist. Despite my intentions of using narrative to alert my students to the injustices suffered by these people, I have had the alarming responses that clearly show that students are not interpreting the stories in the way I intended, that is, to raise awareness of the injustice. These situations invite deeper thinking and perhaps even some theoretical reconsiderations of the assumptions made when thinking that telling the story by someone will lead to an enhanced understanding, when we assume that it will lead to empathy and solidarity by different others. This lack of understanding might stem out of the differences, cultural or ethnic, between the one telling the story and the one listening to the story. But it may well be the case that the indifference is the product of lack of interest in migrants that come to Malta, or that the interest in migrants, also in giving different interpretation to this story, is racist and xenophobic. That is, rising out of the fear that the presence of the other in our country will challenge the extent to which Maltese remain Maltese. I shall not throw away my political convictions of the uses of narratives drawn from the politics of difference of Iris Marion Young. I shall be considering the use of closer to home narratives, narratives of Maltese migrants themselves, to explore the philosophical and practical possibilities of using these narratives to enhance solidarity with migrants. In this respect, I shall ironically be inverting the research methodological principle of using narrative to make the familiar strange. What I shall be seeking here is making the strange more familiar. And now I shall continue with focusing, with presenting a series of reflections. My first reflection draws on Derrida's notion of difference that seeks to subvert binary oppositions. Binary oppositions are representations of two things, aspect, people, in contrast with each other. According to Derrida, these binary oppositions are dangerous in that the contrast is frequently understood in such a way that generally one aspect is devalued, so the other retains its superiority. Let us consider Maltese, migrant. The binary opposition here is that migrants are considered as lesser beings, who for various reasons should and do not and should not or do not enjoy the rights of Maltese. The migrants' inferior position in this binary comes from the fact that they are not yet Maltese, that they perhaps are aspiring to become so. But what is particularly relevant to our narrative inquiry is that sometimes, ironically and paradoxically, the binary opposition is sustained by the devalued representations that migrants' narratives themselves generate. Sometimes, to conscientize others, the narrative inquirer finds herself reproducing and reinforcing the idea of the oppressed other. This point alerts the researcher to the serious ethical and representational issues related to the use of narratives and to her responsibilities of representation. Sharon Todd, who was a well-known philosopher of education, speaks of the unintended consequences of the teacher in using stories for the supposed enhanced understanding of the different others, and how this has the effect, unintended effect, of reinforcing otherness. The educational role of the narrative researcher can be similarly questioned here. When researchers tell the stories of migrants, are they sustaining practices and discourses that construct them, that continue to construct them as migrants? Is it our interest as Maltese researchers to maintain them as migrants, from Africa to the Mediterranean, from boats to detention centers, from detention centers to open ones, from open centers to some other place in Europe? They are destined to remain migrants and never become Maltese. And this leads me to reflection two. Speaking of Maltese migrants through their narratives of migration, that is Maltese migrants' narratives, I'm using this idea to propose a deconstruction of this binary opposition. One can be Maltese as well as migrant. One can be migrant as well as Maltese. The narratives of Maltese migrants effectively represent the particular experiences of a group of people that differentiates them from the Maltese who have stayed in Malta. But the term Maltese migrant deconstructs the difference of being a migrant as one of absolute otherness. The stories show that being a migrant may have something in common with being Maltese. Being migrant means belonging to a group or what Iris Marion Young calls a series. And here she draws on Sartre's idea of the series, of a group that's, whose affiliations are not determined by one's ethnic origins. So the characteristics, the things that makes the group, the series come together is not the ethnic origin, but the conditions outside them that instigated their migrations. This can be effectively done if narratives are not so much preoccupied with identifying the attributes and characteristics of a group, or perhaps the identity, that is, migrants as Africans. Migrants belong to a group not because of some characteristics that essentializes them as migrants, but because of the conditions and contexts, precisely those that emerge from the stories they tell as migrants. So the telling and listening of Maltese migrant stories establishes a relation between Maltese and migrant, and this leads me to reflection three. The idea of relational narratives. The stories of migrants of Ludrovnik that I have read, and the way I have told them and presented them, that is through a representation that is relational, subverts the essentializing tendencies of narratives. This draws attention to the way stories are told and narratives are presented, and more importantly, to the context that ground the stories. Here I emphasize the point that it is the context of the stories that give meaning to difference. In the case of stories of Maltese migrants, this can be exemplified in two ways. Number one, that the narratives of migrants should not only tell the stories of the countries that rejected them or they had to reject. The stories of difference of migrants that mark them as other should look closer into Maltese context, especially the way interactions and relations between Maltese and migrants are locally sustained. And this is the aim of our research project, actually. Maltese migrant stories, like others, are grounded in context of separation from their families. And these themes of separation seem to recurringly emerge from these stories. Migrants are identified by physical separation, by the physical separation of them in Halfar or in an open center. They are separated from the rest at the end of the classroom, in a separate classroom. Through the Maltese migrant stories, here, the notion of the Maltese migrant stories, here I would like to play on this theme of separation from the familiar. Maltese become part of the series of migrants through the stories they hear from more familiar faces and places, from those members of their families that have migrated. They remind one of the closer affiliations they can have with those who migrate. In this sense, more effective and effective affinities with incoming migrants can be realized when local migrants and Maltese people become part of an affinity group. And here again, I draw on Iris Marion Young's notion of the affinity group. My affinity group comprises those people with whom I feel most comfortable, who are more familiar, with whom I share assumptions, affective bonding and networking. And this leads me to my last reflection. Here I introduce the notion of the idea that narratives have to be migrating, that is, that move the people from the usual places that they occupy, from their fixed places of being Maltese. This leads me to the fourth and final reflection on the use of migrants' narrative for migration purposes. And here I am using the term migration in a political and relational sense that reflects on the possibility, on the possibilities of increased understanding through moving from one's own familiar place or position. The act of telling the stories of Maltese migrants has this migrating purpose in mind. It enhances the understanding of local migrants' experiences by making it closer to what is familiar. A migrating narrative has the effect of, and here again I borrow the term from Iris Melionyan Young, political idea of narrative, a migrating narrative has the effect of enlarging one's thought. A migrating narrative does not function to reveal the particular standpoint of the migrant, local or Maltese. It effectively produces knowledges situated closer to the listener, and that they pay attention to the positions, cultural, ethnic, racial, also of the listeners. So by way of conclusion, to my mind, the stories of Maltese migrants can be used for migrating purposes, in that they aid in making one seriously listen and attend to the issues that might seem far removed from oneself. Stories that seem to pertain to the other, but they also pertain to oneself because of the relation to other people that belong to their own affinity group. Thank you.
While Andrew's setting up, I guess I should introduce him since he's been doing all the introductions and now he can't. Dr. Andrew Atzapardi is our newest member at the Department of Youth and Community Studies. He's extremely energetic and always organizing things, so he's brought a real breath of fresh, sort of, you know, new incentive to our program of studies. Andrew's main background is in education, social work, and his main research interests are inclusion. And presently, Simone and himself are doing a research on young people and migrants.
Educational experiences of local migrants, and especially the experience of children in our schools, of these children.
Okay. All right, Andrew, all yours.
Positioning narrative in our research agenda, reading stories of and on inclusion, following the methods. In a bizarre little experiment conducted in 1969, psychologists measured the performance of cockroaches running away from a light source. They found that the cockroaches ran faster if the runway was lined with an audience of fellow cockroaches, each watching from a Perspex box. In other words, the presence of a group had a facilitating effect upon performance. As a researcher who works largely with groups, I found this result strangely comforting. It seemed to provide some sort of natural vindication for my methodology. Transformative thinking depends on the way we engage with the cultural dilemmas we are captivated in, where the context, values, and notions are rooted in a social characterization. The agenda becomes transformative because the individuals primarily involved recognize that this concept of change entails there are no quick fixed solutions. It is a progression and a process which depends on them. My presentation today draws from a research agenda I am constantly engaged with, inclusion. This is the first position or standpoint I would like to take on. Social science research methods are not neutral, but themselves shape the way in which the world is construed. It is therefore imperative for me to be clear about the assumptions underlying the choice of methods and methodology when connecting with the research agenda and in the Pompey process of problematizing. If the research strategy is unsound and the method used are inappropriate, the data and therefore the argument will be undermined. Nonetheless, we need to keep in mind that a method chosen is another method discarded. Research, especially in the complex theme of inclusion, has always been considered a very thorny issue, namely in the minority research realm. Inclusion, fundamentally, is about researching oppression. Researchers should not be reaching mythical independence, but joining with them in their struggles to face up to and overcome the oppressive mindset. The value of narrative lies in the capacity to connect me as a researcher with the story proper that is happening. This is not information that has to go from one medium to another, from one interpretive stance to another, but a whole movement of debate that draws in the complexities straight onto the serving dish. It is precisely like consuming the stark realities that are encompassing this debate. There is no space to shared responsibility and shift the debate. What is read is interpreted from the experience one has, allowing the wholeness and completeness of that debate to merge the positions that need to be taken. I value the importance of detail that every little experience brings with it. When engaging with methods, the social researcher looks for clues, and clues of social behavior are all around you. In a sense, everything you see represents the answer to some important social scientific question. All you have to do is think of a question. It is the strength of narrative that manages to surface these profound, intense, and complex stories of people that know inclusion as an acceptable part of their existence. A new discipline, narratology, a term coined by Todorov in 1969, slowly emerged, which takes as its central task the analysis of stories and narratives. Considering their roles and importance within our lives, there is significant potential for using personal narratives for research purposes. A specific well-established application of narratology in social research is life story, which is the particular presentation I'm using interchangeably with the term narrative. Individuals are invited to tell the story of their lives. The process represents a distillation of experiences. Through life stories, the individual and the social dimension of the informant's experiences meet in a relatively static environment and construe a reflective scenario. I believe that the core of narrative lies in the fact that narrative and storytelling remain bound to a partiality of perspective and thus may reject any form of abstract universalism. Within social action, there are issues of social, cultural, and political belonging. At first, this seems to contrast theory, concept, and narrative, but we also insist on exploring the possibilities of narrative theorizing. The argument always seems to bring it all down to a key notion. Can we feature storytelling as a weak form of universalism? Can we find commonality in the method to the world of inclusion, exclusion, and diversity? Characteristics that are embedded in resilience. Researchers should advocate commitment, not value freedom. Engagement, not detachment. Academics coming from a professional milieu or not can either be with the oppressors or with the oppressed. There is a basic choice that needs to be made. In conceptualizing research as collective, self-reflecting inquiry, some of the suspicion experienced by the informants can be addressed. The use of self, the influence, impact of self, plays an important part in the unfolding of multiple realities. In this sense, research becomes part of a shared enterprise or a joint search for truth, a co-production of knowledge. Using this methodology of narrative life story within the research framework will encourage the informants to reflect on their experience, past and present. Naturally, the use of narrative will obviously shift us towards an interpretivism with a central subjective and possible static account. In this process, we'll be developing a liberating methodology. Valuable research will condition me to develop on this program of inquiry. It will be necessary to refine some of the questions. Each stage is a process of refining and clarifying, so that you end up with a list of questions, tasks, objectives, which you can ask, perform, or examine. Working in a natural setting will support appropriate and real-world research. Developing a case for using particular methods necessitates that as researchers, we are sensitized to the context. Thus, on a theoretical echelon, it is possible to have predictable outcomes, and all those engaged can potentially predict the effects of the process. This will obviously entail that people who are in control of educational, health, welfare, service products are able to position themselves better and produce materials and pedagogies that fit with those emerging and projected needs. If we wish to know about a man, we ask what is his story,
his real inmost story. For each of us is a biography, a story. Each of us is a singular narrative, which is constructed continually, unconsciously, by through and in us. Through our perceptions, our feelings, our thoughts, our actions, and not least our discourse, our spoken narrations. Biologically, physiologically, we are not so different from each other, historically. As narratives, we are each of us unique. This has been quoted from Sachs. Stories converge the strength of testimony with the vigor of outcome. The ability to read what the stories are telling us lies within the reader. It is then the capability of the reader to make the story a part of his or her social understanding. In a contextual scenario where diversity brings in the complexity of social realities, stories help the writer to design a collective identity. Social movements are expressions of collective identity, but they are also sites of contested identities. The use of narrative in social science creates a new way of including informants, and where social research in turn becomes restorative. At times, it feels like people are bringing their story out of the cellars and onto the table for researchers to chop, munch, and devour. The people who generously tell their story recognize that they are different, but they seem to make clear that this difference, this diversity, only becomes relevant at certain times and in particular contexts. These social frameworks that highlight their identity is the way that society elucidates and expounds segregation. All stories speak about a struggle. The informants find themselves having to squeeze their life within a thinking process that is conditioned by a multitude of factors. The people who are narrating the stories are stating clearly that inclusion and exclusion lay at the foundation of the discourse on voice, and how their experiences, their struggles, and their movement can obliterate barriers. Thomas and Zelensky are cited by Plummer as saying that when one is able to analyze the experience of the respective individual, there is data that can be generalized in the understanding of the complex issues that affect a similar context. The same stories revealed sentiments and internal complex emotions of the informants. They spoke about inclusion and how this whole debate was affecting them as they recall events, which manifest how experiences they have gone through in the past have been revisited through their engagement with these stories. They devise into their personal. The narratives touch them deeply enough to get them to speak their thoughts about themselves. Stories have a neglected part of research. However, a number of researchers have thankfully realized that stories are oral literature whose meaning, forms, and functions are rooted in cultural contexts, scenes, and events that give meaning to action. That is what brings us here, in fact, this evening. Stories have been known to carry affluent, valid, and reputable information, which has made the mainstay of my research processes. The effectiveness of storytelling lies in the way this research paradigm is making a contribution to combating the oppression of people who are at the limits of society out of no choice of their own. These stories are useful as they describe the experience and the way we are connecting with these debates in the face of researchers who tend to distort and manipulate data according to what they feel is the experience of marginalized, oppressed, and vulnerable groups. Stories also redefine marginalization and challenge the ideology and methodology of the dominant research paradigm. This methodology matches the emancipatory research paradigm. This whole debate brings in a description of collective experience and the values propagated by the grassroots movements. I struggle with this fact. If knowledge is constitutive of power, as Foucault would have argued, and if welfare and social policy are constitutive of both power and the social, then research, which seeks to provide knowledge, is crucial. I keep asking myself, but what will stories tell me that I cannot see for myself? What will stories represent that I cannot describe? Well, the fact lies in the ability to read the stories, not that have been written, but that can be perceived in between the conversations, the metaphors, and the discourses that are taking place. It is not passively listening to an orchestra at work, as stories are more than individual tales. They are the product of complicated research relationships. They are imbued with history, with theory, with practice and policy implications, and with humanity. What is the point of storytelling? The point is the telling of stories, referring to what a wise man named Goodley once said. Wise? Well, there is a very contentious issue that is being detected here. An outstanding issue in the debate of narrative lies in the ability of the narrator to help the audience experience the biography of the speaker, the circumstances that surround the narration, the credibility of the issues that emerge, and the narrator's view of shaping the narrative. Stories contribute to the revelation of the cultural norms that are at the forefront of the debate in question. This discussion is influenced by the language that is used, the weaving of arguments, the interactions that are taking place, and the metaphor that we engage with. In a way, I feel that narrative has been a way of preserving my identity, of looking at the conversation, of what I represent in the story. These stories, these narratives, are an affirmation of cultural norms and merged in interactional approaches and the telling of events. Narratives are political, as they connect with the various tensions that are created in the search for truth and in the expression of policy and the willingness to call out for change. This epistemology also provides an opportunity for the informants to locate themselves with the oppressive experience and yet manage to see themselves and engage with change, with voice and with conscientization. Stories in themselves generate more stories, more thinking, more reflections than one-dimensional form of research. The most important data that I have gathered on narrative is not drawn from the observation of speech production or controlled experiments, but from the reactions of audiences to the narratives as I have retold them. In a regular and predictable fashion, certain narratives produce in the audience a profound concentration of attention that creates uninterrupted silence and immobility, an effect that continues long after the ending is reached. It is the effort to understand the compelling power of such narratives. Thank you.
You have just listened to the first part of an international seminar organized by the Department of Youth and Community Studies, entitled Captivating the Real in Narrative Research.